Hello and welcome. You are listening to Gore and Guilty Podcast. I'm Greg.
And I'm Georgia.
And today we're covering a very topical case, one that we both know pretty well, but it's a Georgia case, so I'll pass the baton over to her. Georgia, what are we doing today?
So today we're going to be talking about Robert Durst. And some of you might have seen in the news lately, or maybe on one of our posts on Instagram, that he has died this week on the 10th of January 2022. So I thought it was appropriate maybe to do this case today.
Seems like a good time to do it. This guy is just crazy, right? The whole case from start to finish. We both watched the Jinx, which is obviously a documentary about him, but it's been a little while since I watched it, so I think all the details are a little foggy, but all I can remember is that this whole thing is just a super crazy case.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, I think the last time I watched The Jinx as well was back in uni when we both kind of watched it there. And it was just an incredible series. And I know that we've mentioned it a few times in this podcast about how good it is, but it really is really good. And he features in pretty much all the episodes. Like, he's been interviewed by the filmmakers. And there are a few things at the end where it is just unbelievably shocking. This man is, he lies continuously throughout it. And just the contradictions to all of his stories are just insane. So definitely go and watch that. And a little bit of disclosure, I will be saying some spoilers from that documentary series in this episode today.
If I remember correctly, you kind of have to tell some spoilers though, because...
Yeah. Absolutely.
The guy, from what I remember, is just so confident, so arrogant, and just an incredibly compulsive liar. So if you haven't watched The Jinx yet, highly recommend you watch it, maybe before listening to this episode so you get some context.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you get a real feel for him when you see him talk. And how much he just is like this narcissistic kind of presence where he thinks he can outsmart or outwit everybody he speaks to. And it's just, yeah, it's just unbelievable. It is a wild, wild show.
Definitely. Before we start talking about Robert Durst, though, how are you doing, Georgia? How's life?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, so just being busy back at uni this week. It was our first proper week back from since Christmas, and we got thrown straight into the deep end and had a piece of coursework during Friday, but it all went well. So it was actually quite an interesting one. It was all about like social media campaigns, which I found quite interesting, especially with us doing like this Gore and Guilty like social media side. I was like, oh, I kind of know what to do there. Little head start.
Nice. Was it to do with like the psychology of social media?
Just about how to kind of grow a brand, what really works, what doesn't. And we've done like a few little workshops surrounding that. So I kind of feel like I had a little bit of a head start, hopefully. I mean, we'll see what the results say when they come back. But it was, yeah, I kind of enjoyed it. I think I learned a lot from it.
Did you learn some tips for us?
Yeah, hopefully.
Oh, nice. Nice.
I hope so. But yeah, other than that, I was saying to you earlier how I have decided to write a letter, which is a little bit random, but I've decided to write a letter to Sir David Attenborough because I found out a year ago, apparently, he responds with handwritten letters back to you, which I didn't realise he did or even had time to do. So I would regret it if I didn't try. So I'm going to send this letter off today and hopefully get a response. But I'll keep you guys updated.
Nice. Yeah, hopefully he responds. I'm looking forward to hear what he says.
Yeah, super cool. How about you? How's your week been?
My week's been really good. I spent it in London and that was kind of just meeting lots of people from my new job, which was really cool. And
yeah.
Yeah, aside from that, just super busy, super busy. I got to take my car to get it MOT'd, but I'm driving it all the way back to Gloucester for that, which is kind of weird, but...
Well...
Even as an adult, if there's anything wrong with my car, it's just like, ask my dad.
Yeah, same. So,
he arranged the MOT, he arranged the servicing, and I'm just driving to where he wants me to drive. But yeah, no, aside from that, all is well, all is good. And yeah, looking forward to hearing more about Robert Durst.
Yeah. We've got one slight little update as well. There we have been working towards potentially having a website. It's still in the working in progress stage, but I'd like to, you know, keep your eyes peeled because there might be something coming that way related to that, which is really exciting.
Exciting times, exciting times. Watch this space.
Exactly. But without further ado, I think we should start the Robert Durst case.
Let's do it. Let's jump into it.
So as I mentioned before, we decided to cover Robert Durst today because he passed away on the 10th of January 2022, so this week. And again, we will be sharing some spoilers from The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst documentary. So if you haven't seen it, go watch it now and then come back to this episode because it's just unbelievable. So I thought I'd start off with a bit of background about Robert Durst, who he was, what he was like growing up with, and I'm gonna try and stick to chronological order. However, I do slightly jump back and forth with different things being revealed, with more evidence and things like that, so I'll try and keep you all up to speed with it all.
Cool.
Robert Durst was born in Manhattan. He grew up in Scarsdale in New York. He was the eldest of four. There were Tommy, Douglas, and Wendy. His parents were Bernice Herstein and Seymour Durst. Seymour Durst was a real estate giant. In 1902, his grandfather, Joseph Durst, immigrated from Austria-Hungary to the US and became a major real estate manager. In 1927, Joseph created the Durst Organization.
His parents sound like they got very posh names.
Right? Yeah, Bernice.
Seymour.
Seymour. Yeah, you don't really hear those names very... Well, I mean, I don't really know anyone called those names, so...
I feel like Seymour is a pretty cool name, actually. Seymour should make a comeback.
Seymour. It's pretty strong, isn't it? It's a good name.
That is a strong name. Good name.
So tragically, when Robert was about seven, his mother, Bernice, fell from a roof of their house in Scarsdale, and she passed away from her injuries. It was said at the time that it potentially was because she was disorientated with her asthma medication, or it potentially could have been suicide. It was kind of unknown why this happened, but it was very, very tragic. Robert claimed that he was there when it happened. He was present for the incident. However, his brother, Douglas, said that this was absolutely not true. This was the first major incident that occurred in Robert's life. I don't know what, you know, it potentially could have impacted why he is the way he is today.
Possibly.
Yeah. Robert and Douglas didn't really get on. They actually had to go to counselling to improve their brotherly rival. It just was quite hostile between them both. They just really, really didn't like each other. And this occurred when he was like 10, you know, 7 to 10 years old. So it really was quite young when this all developed. In 1953, Robert was 10 years old and his psychiatrist wrote down in a report that Robert potentially had personality discomposition and even potentially schizophrenia, which I think that's quite a young age as well to be diagnosed with those conditions.
So he was battling mental disorders from a very young age.
Yes, yeah, it was, yeah. During his education, he was described as a loner. He would spend a lot of time by himself. In 1965, he was awarded his bachelor's degree in economics. He was very involved with extracurriculum. He was on the lacrosse team and was the business manager for the student newspaper, which was called The Brown and White. He was kind of involved with a lot of other things other than his economics. Studying, making him quite an all-rounder. He began his doctoral program where he met Susan Berman, which, remember that name.
Okay, Susan.
You'll see why. Yes, Susan Berman. He actually withdrew from this course and ventured back to New York in 1969. In 1970, although Robert's family were a big deal in real estate, he actually showed no interest in wanting to work for his father. He just didn't want to be anything to do with this real estate, the Durst organization.
Mm.
He actually wanted to start his own small health food store called All Good Things in Vermont.
Health foods?
Yeah. He opened his own store for health foods called All Good Things.
Well, that is very surprising.
Yeah, right? Especially when you see him. I just didn't really associate those two things together.
Yeah, I mean, does he look very healthy?
Yeah, I don't think he was very healthy, actually. Like, to his, you know, at the end of his life, he definitely wasn't very healthy.
No, I think that's to be expected, though.
Mm.
Interesting. So he wasn't keen on real estate at all. He wanted to go into health foods.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe it was ahead of his time. He could have started the Whole Foods chain before it was Whole Foods.
Right, yeah, actually, that is very true. It was still up and coming during that time. So, yeah, he got onto the boat early.
Mm.
In 1971, he met his wife, Kathleen McCormack. She was also known as Kathy. She was a dental hygienist. After two dates, Robert invited Kathy to live with him in Vermont. She moved in January 1972.
Oh, okay, so the Susan Berman isn't someone that he had a romantic relationship with at this point.
No, no. So you'll see where she comes into it later on.
Cool. I should probably remember this stuff. I just can't.
No, it's quite good. It's good for you. Like, it means that you're responding, like, currently, presently.
Yeah, I'm in the moment.
In the moment, that's the one. 3 years later, in 1972, the store was closed after Robert's father persuaded him to return back to New York to work for the Durst organization. So, the All Good Things store closed after 3 years.
Not the runaway success that he'd hoped it would be then.
No, unfortunately not. The couple both moved to Manhattan, and they were married on the 12th of April 1973, which is actually Robert's 30th birthday.
Okay.
I suppose it probably means he doesn't have to remember two dates. He can just remember when their anniversary is. Oh, it's my birthday. It's quite convenient.
That is a very convenient setup. I'm useless with dates. I was just thinking, yeah. Really, I think Mother's Day soon or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Kathy was studying at the Albert Einstein College for Medicine in the Bronx. She was training to be a pediatrician. She was in her fourth and final year of studying, months away from finishing, when she went missing.
Oh.
On the 31st of January, Kathy visited a dinner party unexpectedly, which was hosted by her friend Gilberta Najami in Newtown, Connecticut. Gilberta said that Kathy actually looked quite upset when she arrived. It was known that Kathy and Robert were arguing that evening. She was wearing clothes that were unusual for her. Usually she wears quite expensive clothes, and she was actually in a red sweatpants, which just really wasn't like Kathy.
Doesn't sound like normal dinner party attire, red sweatpants, so I can see how that would stand out.
Well, even so, she wasn't actually invited to this dinner party. She just, like, kind of came unannounced.
Oh, she just showed up.
Looking upset. Yeah, upset in her sweatpants. And, yeah, it just wasn't Kathy or how Gilberta knew her. She left Gilberta's house and headed towards their house in South Salem in New York after receiving a phone call from Robert. After this, Kathy was never seen again.
So she took a phone call from Robert at the dinner party, left, and that was the last time anyone saw her?
Yes. Yes, exactly. She said she was heading towards the South Asylum house in New York, but no one has reported to have seen her since.
I see.
Robert claimed that he left his wife on the commuter train at Katona Station in New York at 9:15. He said that after this, he went for a drink with his neighbour and then spoke to Kathy on the phone at his place in Manhattan. However, on the Jinx documentary, we hear Robert admit that he actually went home that evening and just went to bed. Quote, "That's what I told the police. I was hoping that would make everything go away." Which I think is quite an unusual statement to say if you've got nothing to do with the disappearance of your wife, you would just say what you did that evening, not say something that in hope to make everything go away, that's what I told the police.
Also, aren't you worried about getting her back?
Right? That should be a main priority. 3 weeks earlier from Kathy's disappearance, she visited the Bronx Hospital to be treated for facial bruises. She explained to a friend that Robert beat her.
Okay.
And that she wasn't going to press charges.
So he was an abuser?
A physical abuser, yes. It seems to be like that. Kathy had asked Robert for a $250,000 divorce settlement. In retaliation, Robert cancelled her credit cards, removed her name from the joint bank account, and refused to pay for her tuition fees. Apparently, the marriage broke down after Kathy wished for children, and Robert did not. Supposedly, Robert forced Kathy to have an abortion.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so it seems like their relationship wasn't good at all.
Yeah, those differences are hard to come over. Also, it sounds like he was an abuser too, so fuck him.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Fuck him, and sorry for Kathy. Kathy actually told one of her sisters, quote, "If anything happens to me, don't let Bob get away with it."
Bob being Robert.
Bob being Robert, her husband. Allegedly, Robert had been dating Prudence Farrow before Kathy went missing and afterwards. Kathy obviously wasn't happy with this. And in court, this is what Robert had to say. Deputy District Attorney John Lewin asked, quote, "You wanted to pursue a relationship with Prudence by your own statement. Kathy did not want you to pursue a relationship with Prudence. And I'm asking you, how did you get that resolved?" Robert responded, "Kathy disappeared." John Lewin said, "Yes, that is how you got it resolved, isn't it? That is how you got it resolved, Mr. Durnst, isn't it?" And Robert responded, "Yes." So he's saying he got the situation resolved by Kathy disappearing. It's just so strange.
Yeah, this is the weird part about the documentary, is he says things that just are unbelievable. Like the confidence, how brazen it is. Like, he knows what he's saying. We know what he's saying. It's still not proof or a confession, because it's technically true, even if he didn't have a part to play in her disappearance. But he's just a very strangely confident man.
It's just strange because he's literally, it seems as though he is literally telling the interviewer, or in this case, the district county attorney, that he did it. But there's just not enough evidence or anything to back it up. He said he got this situation resolved to date somebody else by getting rid of
Kathy. That's the thing. He didn't strictly say that he got rid of her. He said she disappeared and that solved my problem. And that's like why it's not...
Yeah, Kathy disappeared.
It's not a confession.
It's just not quite enough.
It's like as close to the line as you can get for a confession.
It's so infuriating.
And it's like he knows that. It's like he's genuinely playing a game with these people.
Right, like cat and mouse. You know, when, like, I've seen my cats take a mouse, bring it to the centre of the garden, let it run just before it gets to the flower bed, she picks it back up and places it back into the middle. That kind of like just cruel game where he's just teetering on that line but doesn't quite cross it. It's just,
yeah,
oh, this guy. Gilberta and Kathy were supposed to meet at a pub called the Lionsgate in Manhattan, but Kathy never showed up. After this, Gilberta called the police daily for several days, being concerned about her friend who was missing. That same week, Robert decided to report Kathy as missing. 5 days later. So 5 days from when she went missing, that's when he decided to put in a report that he didn't know where she was.
I always find these cases where the missing person hasn't been declared missing for ages, A, really unsettling, and B, just automatically makes their next of kin look super culpable.
It doesn't look right. It almost seems as though they're waiting for a moment where it might be a little bit harder for evidence to be found, just giving them that little bit of leeway, potentially. On the 1st of February, so the following day from when she went missing on the 31st of January, the doorman and the building superintendent at the Manhattan apartment claimed to have seen Kathy. However, when questioned about this, the doorman said that, well, I saw her from behind. It was about a half a block away, and he couldn't quite be sure if it was her, but he thought it was her. Robert's criminal lawyer hired a private investigator, where it was later discovered that the doorman didn't see Kathy. And there was a chance that he wasn't even working that night, so he wasn't even where he was supposed to be, saying that he saw Kathy.
Interesting.
So as if it wasn't true.
What motive could he possibly have for lying, I wonder?
There is somebody that has a lot of money involved in this case.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Maybe. The police found that Robert's story leading up to the disappearance kept changing. There was loads of contradictions. There just wasn't one story that he stuck to. Originally, Robert presented a $100,000 reward for finding his wife, which he then decreased quite quickly to $15,000, which, I don't know, I find that strange.
That is really weird. But equally, surely he knew no one was going to come forward with information anyway, so it's weird that, again, I think it just comes down to him playing games.
Right? It just does seem like that.
Yeah.
3 weeks after Kathy's disappearance, the superintendent at the Manhattan apartment found all of her possessions in the like rubbish compactor. So 3 weeks later, he's like, right, I'll just get rid of all of Kathy's belongings. But remember, she's only missing. There's a high chance she could come back. Unless he knew that she might not be.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so unsettling. 8 years later, after Kathy's disappearance, Robert requested a divorce for spousal abandonment. In 2017, Kathy was declared legally dead. There are many people, including Kathy's family, that believe Robert had something to do with her disappearance. Kathy's mother, 34 years after her disappearance of her daughter, attempted to sue Robert for $100 million for killing Kathy and for denying them the opportunity to bury her. Kathy's mother was 101 at this time, which
Wow. Is
impressive in itself.
She probably brought the loose suit just on the principle of it then.
That she just wanted some closure.
Mm.
In 1999, the New York State Police reopened the case of Kathy's disappearance and searched for the first time Robert's South Island property. You know, the property where Kathy said that she was heading towards the night of her disappearance. The police hadn't even searched that place.
Some questionable police work there. Why?
Wild.
Why do you think they didn't do that?
I don't know whether it's sloppy work or it doesn't make sense to me. If, you know, the Dernst family were so well known, they're almost celebrities during this time, that people knew who they were. They were real estate giants. And then for one of, you know, the eldest son's wife to go missing, you would think that it would have had so much media attention that they, I mean, I think the basic step is, where was she heading towards, on her, you know, what were her final moments? Let's search those places to see whether there are any clues of where she may be. And they didn't do it. I don't know.
Mm.
In 1992, so I know I'm hopping back a little bit, but in 1992, Seymour, Robert's father, broke the tradition of passing the company down to the eldest son. And instead of giving it to Robert, he gave it to his brother Douglas. Remember the rivalry as well.
That has to hurt. That has to hurt so bad.
So they had that rivalry when they were younger. I'm sure it didn't go down very well. But remember as well, though, that Robert didn't want to have anything to do with the organisation. He showed little to no interest throughout. So it's unsurprising that the father may have passed it down to Douglas, who was showing interest, was putting his time into the organisation. It makes sense. However, Robert blamed Douglas for taking the company away from him.
Mm.
Even though he didn't show interest from the start, he still felt he was entitled to that.
Yeah, I imagine he had kind of an external locus of control and would just blame everyone other than himself for these mm-hmm. problems.
Exactly. It caused a rift between Robert and the rest of the Dust family.
Mm.
Robert sued his family for his share of the family fortune and was bought out of the family trust in 2006 for, wait for it, $65 million. Just so much money.
That is a lot of money. A lot of money.
Susan Berman was a really good friend of Robert's. Longtime friend. Remember how I said he met her during his doctoral program in the late 1960s?
Yeah.
She was also the daughter of a well-known gangster who operated in the 1940s.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
Pretty cool. Well, is it cool? I don't know. I think I've just watched too many movies.
Yeah, I imagine it's a bit more sinister than like the Mafia films or a bit of Bugsy Malone or something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's so bad. Maybe we should scrap that. I just got carried away with the...
I've been watching
a lot of Sopranos.
It's all good. It's certainly novel, isn't it, that her father is in a gang?
Yeah, you just don't hear about it that often these days. During the time of Kathy's disappearance, Susan provided Robert with an alibi.
Oh, okay. Was she meant to be the neighbour that he went to have a drink with?
Ooh, that's a good point. I'm not sure exactly what the alibi was, but I guess that would make sense.
I do kind of remember this now from the Jinx. I do, but I don't remember it being a neighbour. I think she...
Because she lived in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Whereas Robert was living in Manhattan, New York at the time. I should have really found out what the alibi was. But nonetheless, so she was the one that provided that. And then this next bit will jog your memory of who Susan was.
Okay, hit me.
On the 24th of December 2000, tragically, Susan was found dead in her home in Benedict Canyon, Los Angeles. She was murdered execution style with a shot to the back of her head at point blank range. The police were called after reports were said that her front door was found open and one of her fox terriers were roaming free. Mysteriously, a few days later, the police received a very interesting letter. It was postmarked... Yeah, is it jogging?
It's all coming back to me now. It's all coming back to me.
Just... So, this mysterious letter was postmarked on the 23rd of December, which would indicate that it was sent a day before the murder occurred. It contained Berman's address and the word cadaver.
Cadaver, yeah, it's all coming back to me now. Cadaver, because there was a link. I remember some people with like theories that because his wife was training to be in the medical profession, that he'd likely heard the word cadaver, which is an unusual word, but he likely heard it from her.
Yes, I think it's just not a usual everyday word. I think when you look into true crime like we do, or it's medical time, it's quite an official terminology of dead body. So he used the word cadaver, and then on the envelope it was addressed to Beverly Hill Police Department. But Beverly was spelt wrong.
I remember that, yeah.
They had added an extra E between the L and the Y. Robert was reportedly in the area during this time of the murder and had flown back to New York the day before Susan was found. It was discovered that Robert had sent Susan two lots of $50,000. However, Robert said that he only sent her $25,000, which I think is just, I don't know, an unusual. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, maybe she was blackmailing him or something.
Yeah. Or is he paying her for her alibi that she may have provided?
Yeah, possibly. Possibly.
Possibly. I mean, it's all, yeah.
We'll never know.
So I'll come back to that letter later down the line when we discuss the trial. So all of this was recurring, you know, Susan's death, all was at the same time as Kathy's disappearance was being reopened. So in 2000, the case was reopened, Susan was found murdered. So Wendy, Robert's sister, told Robert all about this, that the case was being reopened, and on the 31st of October 2000, he hatched a plan and he went into hiding and travelled to Galveston in Texas, where he disguised himself as a mute woman called Dorothy Sinner. She's just another oddity to this whole case.
It is crazy. He's just doing the strangest things. I'm convinced he's like in his head trying to think of the weirdest disguise he can come up with, and he's gone with a mute woman.
I don't know. It's just very, yeah. Nearly 1 year later, on the 9th of October 2001, Robert was arrested in Texas after, trigger warning, body parts were found. They belonged to Robert's 71-year-old neighbour, Morris Black. The body parts were found floating in the Galveston Bay. He was released on $250,000 on bail, which he paid. He missed his court hearing on the 16th of October, and a warrant was set out for his arrest for jumping bail. This bit I find particularly strange. On the 30th of November, he was caught shoplifting in Wegmans supermarket in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Whilst he was wearing a wig, he shoplifted plasters, a newspaper, and a chicken salad sandwich. And it was said that he had $500 in his pocket at the time. So there really was no need for him to shoplift.
I think some people do it for the thrill, and Robert Durst was probably one of those people.
Yeah, you're probably right. I think, though, it is strange as well that this brought an end to his 45-day manhunt. Like, this is what got him caught. If he was trying, I don't know, was he wanting to get caught at this point? Like,
very possibly. It seems like a lot of the things he does are orchestrated by him. Maybe I'm giving him undue credit, but I think even, like, some of his strangest behaviours, or even the behaviours he does that lead to him getting arrested or whatever, a lot of them feel planned.
Yeah, there is that kind of air. I think it's just all very strange.
Yeah.
The police searched his rental car at the time and found $37,000 in cash, They found marijuana, 2 guns, and Morris Black's driving license. He also had directions to Gilberta's home, which I think is rather ominous.
Yeah, that's kind of creepy. She was probably in danger.
Mm. He had 100 million in assets at the time as well. Apparently during this time on the run, he stalked his brother Douglas. Remember that he had 2 guns in the car, so again, it's just super creepy. In 2003, he was put on trial for the murder of Morris Black. The defence found it difficult to communicate with Robert, and after a 70-hour examination, Robert was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome.
70 hours? 70?
Yes, that's what I saw online. I don't think it was all in one sitting. It probably was like multiple assessments that would have equated to 70 hours.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
They said that his behaviour could be justified by this diagnosis. The defence claimed that Morris died in self-defence. The prosecutor said that there'd be no lesser charge suited to this crime other than premeditated first-degree murder. During the trial, Robert explained that Morris had grabbed Robert's .22 calibre target pistol and threatened to use it on him. He said that during the struggle, the gun fell to the floor and shot Morris in the face. So trigger warning completely now. After Morris died, Robert used a paring knife, an axe and 2 saws to dismember his body before bagging his remains and placing them in the Gaveston Bay. His head was never found.
You've got to be some kind of psychopath to do that. I don't know how anyone could kill a person and then do that. I don't know how anyone could kill a person anyway, to be fair, but...
Yeah, no, I know. It just takes it to that additional sinister level. It's just so, so awful.
Gross.
It was said at the time as well that potentially Morris had been killed because he found out Robert's true identity.
Okay, so he could have come back to blackmail again.
Sounds plausible. Due to a lack of evidence, Robert was acquitted for the murder of Morris Black on the 11th of November 2003. So he was never charged for the murder.
It's one of those people where everyone knows this guy is a wrong-un. This guy is no good, and in all likelihood probably had killed all 3 of the people he was linked to. But because he's just smart enough to not leave any smoking gun, he never really got caught. Well, I know he does eventually, which I'm sure we'll talk about soon, but...
Yes, yeah.
It's for a long time he got away with it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. On the 21st of December 2004, Robert pled guilty to 2 counts of jumping bail and 1 count of evidence tampering, which referred to the dismemberment of Morris's body, which I'm pretty sure there's a higher charge associated with dismemberment.
What are they saying? Like, they said, yeah, we believe that you cut up his body, but we can't say for certain that you killed him.
Yeah, I guess so.
Wow, weird.
Robert entered a plea bargain and received a 5-year sentence. His time that he'd served before was deducted, which meant that he only served a further 3 years for this. On the 15th of July, Robert was on parole, which meant that he had to stay close to where he was living, and he had to request permission if he wanted to travel further afield. Of course, Robert didn't stick to this. He decided to make a trip to Morris's apartment and visit the shopping mall. At the shopping mall, he ran into Judge Susan Criss, who actually led his trial. So he was sent back to jail. The chances of him bumping into the judge that took his trial, so obviously knew what his requirements were during his parole, out shopping, it's just, yeah.
Yeah, that is crazy. This guy has a surprisingly high amount of bravery. Mm. Wow, that makes it sound like I'm giving him credit. It just is, like I said...
So
very strange for him.
So blasé about it all.
Yeah.
In 2015, Judge Susan Criss made the comment when asked if she thought that Robert had killed Morris. She responded saying, quote, "You could see that this person knew what they were doing and that it was not the first time. The body was cut perfectly, like a surgeon who knew how to use this tool on this bone and certain kind of tool on muscle. It looked like not the first time job, and that was pretty scary." So even the judge knew that there was more to this, but there was not enough evidence. He was released again on the 1st of March 2006. Between 2012 and 2013, Robert was accused for trespassing the Durnst family property in Manhattan. However, after being trialed, he was found not guilty.
Would he like turn up to his old family's?
Yeah, and it seems as though he was just like creeping about a little bit and he wasn't welcomed. And Robert said this about that, quote, "I'm not spending my time running around 43rd Street wanting to shoot my brother." Which is just, he just said a lot of strange comments. In 2015, the documentary, The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, was released, which highlighted his crimes and featured Robert Durst himself being questioned throughout. So spoiler alert, this is the absolute spoiler, the end finale. So at the end of the documentary, Robert uses the bathroom, but forgets that his mic is still recording. In there, he says to himself, quote, "There it is. You're caught. You're right, of course. But you can't imagine. Arrest him. I don't know what is in the house. Oh, I want this. What a disaster. He was right. I was wrong. And the burping? Oh, I'm having difficulty with the question. What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course." And it's just this like utter rambling of like, it just all flows out of him. It was reported though after this that the comments had potentially been altered by the filmmakers to be put into a more, I don't know, impactful order. But all of those words did come out of Robert's mouth. It's as though he confessed, right?
I mean, yeah, there's a couple of things there. Firstly, like the whole premise of The Jinx is just crazy in itself. Like the accused killer willingly going on to a full documentary where he has to answer very forward questions. And then it's interesting you said he forgot his mic was left on. Did he actually forget?
Yeah, exactly. Whether it just all got a bit too much and he just needed to like let it all out. But it's very narcissistic, I think, that this whole documentary was basically trying to get these answers out of Robert, trying to, you know, poke the bear enough for him to just spill it all and just get those secrets out of him. And he felt confident enough to hold it together throughout the 10 episodes, I think it is, or 6 episodes, where he's holding it together to not share too much. And then right at the end, it all just kind of bumbles out of him.
Yeah, I think it's interesting the way that it all comes out at the end. I remember thinking that maybe he purposely left his microphone on just because he wanted to create that like extra layer of drama for what is effectively a tribute to his life and the crimes that he's committed. It obviously wasn't intended that way by the documentary makers, but it is, let's be real. Like they're talking to him because he's got this interesting dynamic around some murders, and it's like didn't he? Everyone watching it knows. Robert Durst probably knows that most people strongly believe that he did these crimes. So yeah, I thought at the time maybe his confession, which still wasn't like super
again,
clear,
yeah,
may have actually been him toying with people and he accidentally took it too close to that line.
Yeah, exactly. On the 4th of March 2015, he was arrested for first degree murder of Susan Berman. He was staying in a hotel in New Orleans. The police found a range of items in the room: his birth certificate and passport, 5 ounces of weed, maps of Louisiana, Florida, and Cuba, a flesh-toned latex mask. It's really creepy.
Flesh-toned? Mm,
I know,
creepy.
Right? It's just, I guess, a gas of disguise. Fake IDs. 42,631 dollars in cash, and a new phone. It was also said that a further 117,000 in cash was sent to Robert by a friend, and after looking through his bank statements, it was found that he had withdrew 315,000 in cash just over a month prior. So it looked as though he was planning to run away to Cuba after the jinx was released, as there is no extradition treaty there. So if he managed to get there, and this all came out that he's just now confessed pretty much, nearly, that if he manages to get there, that the US can't get him back.
Which is very intriguing and maybe lends to what I was just saying about, like, did he intend to actually leave his mic on and create the drama and then just go to Cuba anyway?
Yeah, it seemed like the... Sorry. Yeah, it seemed as though the plan had already been set. Whether, you know, sort of a mic drop moment. There you go. I've had it. I've told you what you wanted. Now see you later. Because he just wanted to have, you know, the last laugh sort of thing.
Yeah, I think so. He definitely would be that sort of person that always wants to have the final say.
Mm-hmm. In February 2017, Mike Chavin was a close friend of Robert's and actually was his best man during Robert and Kathy's wedding. He stood on the stand and said that Robert had confessed to him to killing Susan. Douglas, Robert's brother, also testified against him. The preliminary trial was postponed in April 2018 as his defence team suffered damage to their offices and homes during Hurricane Harvey. Robert pled not guilty to murdering Susan. The trial was set for the 9th of September 2019. The judge said that the prosecutor could present evidence involving Morris's murder, which I thought was quite interesting, how usually they kind of keep cases quite separate, but they thought, you know what, we're going to allow other evidence coming in to kind of paint a picture of who Robert was.
I think they had to, really, because... I mean, I understand why they normally do that, and they say, like, right, these are two very distinct cases, but this guy's been linked to so many
and he
so
just hasn't been
cases.
Caught. Like, he hasn't, like, got his comeuppance. So, you remember the letter that was sent to the police referring Susan's murder?
About the cadaver.
The cadaver, yeah, and the Beverly spelt wrong. It was actually matched with a letter that Robert produced in 1999, as a match for Robert's handwriting, as well as the misspelling of Beverly. Robert's defense attorney claimed, though, that this evidence was illegally obtained. But on the 24th of December 2019, the defense attorney backtracked and said, hang on a minute, actually, I think Robert did write the letter. Even though Robert had denied throughout that he did not write that letter, during Jinx, Robert said to the filmmaker that the person who wrote the cadaver note was taking a big risk because it was something that only the killer could have written.
Mm.
He also told his godson, Howard Altman, the person who wrote that note killed her. So he's already, there's evidence of him openly recorded saying whoever wrote that note killed Susan, and then the defense attorney has come back, retracted what they first initially said, and claimed that, well, quote, the note demonstrates that the person who mailed it was aware that there was a body in the house and not the individual that murdered Susan Berman.
Oh, okay, so they changed. So at first it was like, no way did Robert write this note. And then eventually it was like, he did write the note, but actually he wasn't the killer. He just happened to find the body and for some reason wanted to tell the police this way rather than just calling 911.
Exactly. But he just was aware that there was a body in the house, because obviously the evidence of the handwriting, the misspelling of Beverly, all just came back to Robert. They couldn't deny that. So then they were like, oh, well, maybe we can manipulate this story and say that he just knew that there was a body in the house. But what caught him out was him throughout Jinx saying, whoever wrote that note killed the person, and telling his godson, whoever wrote it killed the person. He's already said, he's already linked that connection. So it is also his own fault, basically.
Yeah, he wouldn't really be doing that if he knew he'd found the body and wrote that note and hasn't killed Susan.
Mm-hmm. The final trial was supposed to happen on the 5th of August 2021. However, court was adjourned to the 9th of August because the defence team had COVID.
Lots of postponements.
Yeah, exactly. Robert was on the stand for 14 days. The LA County Deputy, John Lewin, the one who questioned him before, he questioned and questioned Robert for about his credibility. Robert admitted that he lied during the trial of Morris Black and that he had lied 5 times during this trial. So basically he was saying that what he's saying is just unreliable. One of the prosecutors said that Robert had said during Susan's murder, I had to do it. It was me or her. I had no choice. With over 80 witnesses and nearly 30 exhibits, his tanglement of lies was seen. And on the 17th of December 2021, Robert was convicted of first-degree murder of Susan Berman. And on the 14th of October 2021, he was sentenced to life imprisonment without a chance of parole. However, as we know, Robert died in prison only 3 months later, on the 10th of January 2022. He was 78 years old. He had caught COVID, which accelerated other medical conditions, and he officially died of cardiac arrest.
Well, I'm glad they caught him and found him guilty and put him away before he died.
Yes, I feel like that was, at least it was a little bit of justice. It is a shame, though, that he is 78 years old and that's when he was arrested. I mean, he's committed like heinous, heinous crimes. And at 78, he's like, oh, okay, I guess I'll go to jail now. It's just so infuriating.
That's true. I guess, in a way, he did kind of get away with it.
Yeah. There's a couple other things I wanted to include. It seemed as though that he may have been involved with other disappearances and murders. So, during the time of the murder of Susan, the police were interested in understanding if Robert had any connections to two disappearances at the time. 18-year-old Lynn Scholes from Middlebury, Vermont. Lynn used to frequently visit the Good Health store, All Good Things, that Robert ran, and actually visited the store the day of her disappearance and was last seen near a bus stop near the store. So they haven't got any more evidence other than that. But it's a weird and strange coincidence. Or did he have something to do with it? The second one was 16-year-old Karen Mitchell from Eureka, California, who went missing. She used to volunteer at a homeless shelter, which Robert visited. Robert would dress as a woman in women's clothing at the time and would visit Karen's aunt's shoe shop. Karen was seen walking from her aunt's store and was potentially talking to someone in a car at the time of her disappearance, and a witness sketch depicts a person that looks similar to Robert.
Interesting. We should share that sketch on the Instagram if you can find it.
Absolutely. And finally, the police wondered if he had a connection to a 1997 disappearance of 18-year-old Kirsten Modafaria, who was last seen in San Francisco. So that is the case of Robert Durst. He is just an unbelievable killer. His story's wild, basically. And go and watch The Jinx.
Yeah, watch The Jinx, because it's an awesome show. But yeah, Robert Durst is vicious. very sinister. And just, but equally, and this is kind of bad, but it is kind of fascinating. This guy,
his journey,
has just done some of the most bizarre behaviour that you'd ever see from anyone. The fact he got away for so long is crazy.
That's the strangest part, is that he just seems so blasé about it all and kind of almost said the truth throughout. But it just, he knew that there just wasn't quite enough to sentence him down.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for walking through that episode. It's always a challenge to fit so much information into just an hour, but you did awesome.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, especially with, you know, the documentaries and stuff, there's so much information about him and hours, and I just wanted to get the main bits into it, but I definitely think you should go and have a look at other strange things that Robert got up to, because it's just, what a case.
Do you want to run through the socials in case anyone wants to share any thoughts on Robert Durst?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can follow us on our Instagram at Gore and Guilty Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Gore and Guilty. If you have any true crime or paranormal stories that you'd like to be featured in maybe a potential future episode, then please email us on goreandguiltypodcast@gmail.com. If you have liked this episode, then please give us, you know, maybe some stars on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, some reviews, all of that lovely stuff. And if you have any case suggestions as well, send those in too. So we hope you enjoyed this episode. And remember, we won't judge if
Gore is your guilty pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.